Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is Andrew Fazekas. He's the night sky guy, and he writes the Starstruck column for NationalGeographic.com. He's also a syndicated contributor to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, their radio network, and he's an astrophysicist or astronomer? Which one is it?
I'm an astronomy communicator.
Astronomy really, communicator. Is that a fancy word for stargazing geek?
you could say that, yeah. I like that.
Because I think a lot of us are, because I've been fascinated with just the stars and the planets since I was very little. One of my earliest memories was my mom coming to get me saying, "Look, honey, they're landing on the moon."
Oh, wow.
I think I was like four. That's amazing. I remember running outside after she told me that to look up at the moon and see if I could see them up there. Like I said, I was four.
Amazing.
So your book is Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. Now, this is mostly a guide to the night sky as we see it, our solar system, our galaxy, but you've incorporated how it matches up with Star Trek in here. How did that come about?
Well, it's an interesting story because for me, the two worlds, you know, of Star Trek and sky watching have always been intertwined. Since my early childhood, I really got into Star Trek probably in my elementary school years when I was probably like 5, 6 years old, and my dad introduced me to the original series, probably one of its first reruns. This was in the mid 1970s, and I mean, I'm from Canada, Montreal, Canada, and in there, that was one of the first reruns that we had on Sunday mornings, and it was a ritual. Mm-hmm. Every week we would watch it, and I would barrage my dad with questions about, you know, about these destinations they were going, all these alien worlds and these stars that they would be orbiting and all these neat things. And I think I broke my dad down and he ended up buying a telescope. And we would use that telescope he introduced me to a lot of really neat stuff. My dad was always a naturalist, loved to go out camping, fishing, hiking. And so we spent a lot of time outdoors. And so it was a natural fit. And we always loved looking at the stars, but you know, all my life, but at that young age, I was very obviously very impressionable, and he bought this department store telescope, nothing fancy, but it allowed us to really have our own little cosmic adventures. And I remember seeing like Jupiter and its cloud belts and moons and Saturn and its rings and star clusters, and it made quite an impression on me. And so, you know, that we were doing that around the same time that we were watching Star Trek episodes. So the two really fed off of each other, I found, in terms of my interest. And then flash forward to as a young adult, I've been a part of an amateur astronomy society here in Canada. It's called the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and it has about 5,000 members spread out across the country in all the major cities across Canada. And in Montreal, I was a club member from a young age, and part of what we did as a club is to go out and do public star parties. So I would bring out my telescopes and be able to show people the night sky. And what I realized is that whenever I invoked Star Trek analogies or referenced Star Trek in viewing objects in the night sky, that piqued people's interest. And so over the years, I had sort of put together a quick list of some objects that appeared in episodes and movies that I enjoyed looking at, and it would be something that I could show them in the night sky, and so have that kind of neat list handy with me. And it grew over the years, and so that became the skeleton of the backbone of this, actually of this book that now has come to fruition. So that's really how that initial idea came. And then when I became a science journalist, the writer, science writer, I was coming up with some ideas about 10 years ago for book ideas. And I said, well, this seemed like something that would make an interesting book and something that's very unique, looking at the astronomy, focusing on the astronomy of Star Trek. And so that was about 10 years ago. And however, at that time, my wife and I decided to have children, and we had two children back to back. And that whole idea of being an at-home writer and having children sort of put this idea of writing books on the back burner, because I had to, of course, make ends meet. So being a writer of a new science news writer, that was much more imperative for me to make ends meet. So I put those, I said, maybe this isn't the time for me to deal with such heavy, stuff, time-consuming stuff. So I said, when my kids get older, I'll revisit the idea. And then in the interim, I became a columnist, astronomy columnist at National Geographic, writing news and sky-watching columns for them for 8 years now. But 2 years ago, they approached me. I got a call from an editor at the book division in National Geographic saying, Andrew, we've been following your column. We love your sky watching stuff and your astronomy news things. Would you be interested in writing a book for us? Well, like, it didn't take me long to say, yeah. How many times have you heard of being approached by a major publisher if you'd like to write a book for us? And I said, yeah. So they were thinking of, doing a riff on my articles, basically, something on that, on my skywatching thing. But then 15 minutes into my conversation with the editor, she said, asked me, it says, this is all good. However, if you have an idea, Andrew, if you have something else in mind, we'd be open to hear it. So I pitched, I said, well, actually, I can pitch you this idea. I'm not sure if it fits National Geographic, but why not? So I said my idea for the Star Trek book, and immediately they were very interested. And we talked at length about it in our conversation. This was back in 2014 in the summer that year. And we realized very quickly that it was a perfect storm for a book like this to come out, because it was the 50th anniversary of the franchise in 2016, and the next movie in the reboot series was coming out. So it was all kind of perfect. Like, everything just came. It instinctively, to me, said that this is the perfect time for such a book to come out. And nothing, and the fact that nothing like it had ever been published, this connection between stargazing, skywatching, and the Star Trek together has never been done before. So it was something that really was the perfect timing.
The book is gorgeous. It's the photographs in there are amazing, as always. And the maps you draw up of here's the scene and here's where it is. What that level of detail just shows how much of a Star Trek geek fan you are, and the work that went into, I'm guessing, the science of figuring out where some of these places were. How much research did you actually have to dig into to find these locations?
Well, like I said before, I had a core list of objects that I've always had handy with me. That was the spine of the book, but I realized that there were to do a book like this correctly, a guide, I had to have examples of different types of objects. Where I'm coming from, my wheelhouse is skywatching, stargazing, actually practical experience being out under the stars and finding things in the night sky. And as a science journalist, explaining to people, how, some of the discoveries, astronomical discoveries come to be, what they mean, put them in context, translate all that scientific gobbledygook into something that's understandable for the general public. and teach people how to navigate the night sky. And so what I realized in putting this book together is that I did have to make sure that there are representatives of different types of celestial objects. So, and that would make sense. I mean, this isn't a guidebook. I have to say, it's not a replacement for other kind of stargazing guides. There's plenty on the bookshelves out there that you can go if you want to begin stargazing, just a strict stargazing guide. However, this is, you know, something unique in that it brings the hook of Star Trek, allowing people in a very unique way to get introduced to stargazing in many ways and understand the astronomical science of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And so I made sure that I would have make sense to the scientific crowd as well. People who are science geeks would understand the way it's structured, the book. So I would start off with all the destinations of Star Trek that involve the solar system. Then I would move out farther, talk about exoplanets, planets beyond around other stars, and that's a staple, right, of all Star Trek. And then move into describing stars themselves, the lives of stars, and clusters of stars and galaxies, finally. And so it just made a logical sense, and then it just took I had the hard time of watching, over 700 episodes. it was hard work, but somebody had to do it, right? It's, and pick and choose. And I have to say, I have to give a big tip of the hat. It was such a monumental work. It would be impossible to do even within 2 years without the help of the fandom out there of Star Trek, particularly when it comes to the Wikipedia site Memory Alpha. Right, it's a tremendous lexicon of information that's there online, and it helped me tremendously with all these fans helping in terms of focusing which episodes really have astronomical plot lines in there, or at least that wonderful cosmic backdrop layout. I had that available, so. It was really what I realized through my research in 2 years that there was actually too much to contain in one book. Maybe one day we'll have a second or third volume. There's plenty out there,
wow,
fodder of information. But I had to sort of give a cherry pick episodes to that gave a good enough representation of these different types of celestial objects, and that's what I hope I've done with this book here.
Now, was it easier or more common to find what you needed from the original series, from Next Generation, from Voyager, or the movies? Which was it more typical for you to find the correlations that you needed with certain sky objects?
Honestly, I found there was plenty in all the different series and movies. The fact is that there's just too much out there. Star Trek, I have a newfound respect for Star Trek. I mean, I've always been a fan of Star Trek and sci-fi in general. And what has always appealed to me is, in a science fiction series or movie, is when they really pay attention to the science, and particularly when it comes to space travel, the astronomical science. I really enjoy that. I savor it. And in Star Trek, what I love is that they've always had this basic foundation of science that's been there since the beginning, 50 years ago. What's changed is our knowledge of the universe and also the technology of computer technology that has allowed us, or Hollywood, basically, to create hyper-realistic visions of the universe that we now enjoy today, right? If you go to any of these space-based movies, we expect as an audience to have these wonderful visual effects, but and we're much more savvy today than we were 50 years ago. Let's be honest. In the general public is, I should say, much more savvy in terms of what space is like. Simply because we're exposed to, things that NASA discovers. I mean, you look at the Curiosity rover on Mars. We can get pictures almost in real time. When the scientists get it, when JPL, NASA get those images, you can have access to them practically almost instantly. They do, and so this has influenced, I think, today's generation and what they expect in visions and on the screen. And I think Star Trek, all throughout its incarnations, all the different, the 6 television series and the 13 movies and counting, have all done their best with the knowledge of the times. You know, if you go back to the original series, yeah, they're kind of campy and hokey, especially by today's standard. You know, you look at it through today's eyes, it's very hokey. But, you know, the representations were at the best that they could at the time. And they did that knowingly. I mean, they involved real researchers, scientists from NASA and academia, who consulted with the writers in fleshing out those visions that we see, all those adventures playing out. So for me, putting this book together, I tried to balance it as best as I could, as involving all the different television series. It was a true challenge, because I had to say, well, what would I drop, or what do I want to focus on? Maybe in certain cases it was the plot line was strong as possible. That's really what I was focusing on, that involved an astronomical object, or perhaps it was something that was visually extremely appealing. Usually what I tried to do is do both, something that was strong in the plot and something that was visually appealing. I didn't always work out, but with those two components, either of those, it would make something of a much more compelling read for the audience.
Wow. Now, what are you hoping the Star Trek connection with the stargazing sparks in people who might read this?
Well, you know, being a science educator, communicator, my dream, my passion really has always been sharing the wonders of the universe. You know, my brand is the night sky guy. So it's just followed me throughout my life. And I love sharing with people the views of the night sky through a telescope or binoculars, or just simply, you know, pointing it out at something in the sky and just having that gee whiz moment, sharing just that the idea that there's more to nature than what's around us that we see in our everyday life, you know. And there's, you know, today there's this disconnect, I have to tell you, with the universe. When you, just to give you an idea, I mean, I would bring up the idea of the Milky Way, and the first thing that youngsters would think of would be the chocolate bar Milky Way. They don't think of what the real home galaxy that we live in, that's up in the sky visible. We're disconnected. We live in cities, you know, where there's heavy light pollution. We have our handheld devices, and we just, you know, walk and ride on buses and everything, and we're just looking at our handheld. We're disconnecting ourselves than ever before from the universe in a visceral way. And so with this book, what I'm hoping is to have a reconnection for many people out there. People love Star Trek. I mean, there are legions of fans throughout the world. It's a beloved franchise. And it naturally draws people in who are interested in a hopeful view of humanity's future, and are interested in the science and technology and love that, have a deep passion for that. And what I'm hoping is that it allows people, fans, for instance, of Star Trek, to watch their favorite episodes, have this book handy in the living room as they're watching, and maybe reference some of the science there, be able to follow up on what they're seeing how real the science and technology is, and then being able to go outside, step out their door, get off the couch, get off that couch and get outside and look up. And have your own cosmic adventure. Have your personal connection to what you've just seen on your TV screen. And so perhaps maybe instilling some interest towards the night sky, in getting parents with their children together. Maybe the parent is really into Star Trek but is also would love to have the kid involved in science or get them involved in Star Trek too. This it goes vice versa. Having teachers maybe use this book in their curriculum. I've had some college professors who said, "Well, you know what? They teach an astronomy class to non-science students, and it's always hard for them to get them engaged." Well, this book may be a tool that they can offer to engage the kids, you know, a little bit more, as having Star Trek as a jumping off point in investigating science and astronomy.
Now you have me considering all sorts of technological possibilities. Like, National Geographic should probably put out an app for tablets and smartphones that incorporate the objects and the Star Trek episodes, so folks can go outside and still have their devices. So they're off the couch, but they still have their devices, and they're using their devices to connect with the sky gazing. That could be fun.
It could very well. I mean, and we're living in the age of when we have this kind of technology where we can really immerse ourselves in a virtual universe, practically. And you're right. I mean, these are things that are happening now already. But you know what? It's interesting. You bring this up of these kind of technologies like apps and tablets. Well, you know, it's not by accident that our computer tablets look the way they do. You know, when the iPad came out, you know, everybody's looking at it. And, you know, right away, I remember hearing from all the Star Trek fans, seeing it on social media and stuff, like, hey, this looks like, you know, what Captain Kirk used. You know, on the bridge, he was always referencing, you know, being put on his lap, this tablet computer, you know. And so it's not by accident, because the folks that are the inventors of this, these kind of technologies, in many cases, they were directly inspired by Star Trek, you know, as youngsters. Because if you look back, it makes sense in terms of timing. Star Trek came out in the late 1960s at a time when, you know, the younger generation had a hopeful, optimistic view of the future. You know, the Vietnam War was just starting to heat up. The Cold War between the U.S. and the old Soviet Empire was really hot at that time. And there was just, you know, a lot of troubled times as well. But hopeful, the youngsters wanted to see something. So there's this desire to see something on television, on their TV screens in their living room that would be hopeful. And Star Trek was very different. At the time, you had Lost in Space, My Favorite Martian, which was more fantasy, comedic versions of what, you know, what space travel may be like. But here you had suddenly this realistic vision, something that showed that maybe in 200 years from now, humans might put aside their petty differences and work together in a racially mixed, crew, and this almost utopian type of vision of what humanity was like. And they've put everything past, and they're moving in the cosmos, exploring that final frontier. And so it's really amazing. At that time, I think, you know, a lot of today's inventors, scientists, astronomers, astronauts, were youngsters at the time seeing this, and I think it planted a seed in their minds that was there today. And then when they became of age in their careers, you know, I think that it's obvious. It's not an accident why many of these inventions are the way they are, because these seeds were planted at that time.
So much to explore. And not enough time in the day to do it.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Star Trek is a gift that keeps on giving, I tell you.
And I have so many friends, it's like they'll come up with Star Trek references for this or for that, and just huge fans of the show and the influence it has had on other science fiction shows and on scientists who got into their fields either because of watching those shows, or maybe even were already in those fields and decided to explore an idea that those shows inspired them to have. That cycle is what I think keeps on giving, because The show inspires an idea in a scientist. The scientist follows it through, comes up with something new. And then that inspires a writer to write an episode of whatever sci-fi show they're working on. And it just continues.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, any good science fiction, you know, I've talked to a lot of authors, scientists who like science fiction. So they all, everyone's told me, and I agree, is that any good, real good science fiction story has to have a good, solid science base to it. And Star Trek has followed through time and time again with that. And it is this neat cycle, because that's what appeals, the fact that it has this science base is what appeals to so many people, generation after generation, right? So I think it's really, really nice that you have that cycle, because it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that's coming to pass. You know, a lot of people are thinking, like, will we really be able to create a future that we see in Star Trek? It may very well happen. It's in a sense, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, if we look, you know, my mind is racing because I'm thinking, you know, all different things that I've encountered in the last few months that my book has come out. I'm meeting a lot of fans. I'm talking a lot, which is fantastic, because I'm finally having that real interaction with the fan base, which is something so special, I find, having been locked away for 2 years with just working by myself on this. This is, coming away from this, I think that it's a self-feeding thing, this Star Trek, in terms of what's possible for the future. I think Star Trek represents these things which inspire scientists, and they are even working on things that people, you know, a lot of people say is impossible, like warp drive. There are real scientists working on the idea of warp drive, and it seems like theoretically it would be possible. I mean, if that is possible, if we could develop a propulsion system that allows us to travel between the stars at extremely high speeds, high enough that it's possible to get to a star in, say, a few weeks' time, or maybe in a few months' time, that would be tremendous in terms of our ability to really spread out in the cosmos and really create a Star Trek future for ourselves. You know, it goes way beyond us. You know, everybody's focusing on going on Mars now, but it goes way beyond Star Trek. You know, if you look at the Star Trek history line, Mars was first explored in the 2030s, the first missions called the Ares mission. Isn't that funny? Because now you look at what NASA's doing. Let's look at their timeline. 2030s is when the first human expedition should be going. It's almost, I'm almost going, I hope they name it the same as they did in Star Trek series. You know, just keep it going, you know. And it's almost like this self-feeding prophecy. It's really, and it's not by accident, because the folks involved with it, they really love Star Trek, and it's inspired them so much that they almost, it's willing it into existence, you know. It's really amazing.
Excellent. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It truly is.
Now, where can people find you online?
Well, folks can visit me on my website, thenightskyguy.com. I also have the same handle on Twitter and Facebook, The Night Sky Guy. I love to hear from fellow Trek fans and new stargazers. If there's any questions about The Night Sky, I'd be more than happy to answer that.
Again, the book is Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. It's out from National Geographic. You should be able to find it in your bookstore or on your favorite online book purveyor. And we'll have links to that. Again, thank you, Andrew.
Well, thank you very much, and live long and prosper.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award with weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
I enjoy a good science talk just like almost any geek does. I say almost because I'm not sure. There may be sci-fi geeks out there who have no interest in science whatsoever. Yet, I have not met any, so that probably means I need to get out more. That's all I'm saying on that subject. But this book, Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages, this book is beautiful. The star images that are in there, the pictures, the maps of constellations, it's absolutely gorgeous. And they explain what you're looking at in a Star Trek episode based on real objects in the night sky. So it really is a good introductory guide to stargazing and deep sky objects that might not otherwise be of interest to people. You say, hey, you know, you saw this object in such and such an episode of Star Trek. And they go, really? So in some ways, it could be a good conversation starter at a con. It's kind of a big book to carry around with you at a con, but you never know. Anyway, not sure how much Star Trek content we've got left coming up. Several people who were going to write essays can no longer meet those deadlines. And one or two more specific Star Trek series guests that I have been trying to line up for several months also have not confirmed yet, so I don't even know if those are going to happen. We shall see. I'm lining up stuff for the fall television season, as always, so looking forward to that coming in October. And of course, a few more monster movies, because we need more monster movies. It's a necessity. It is a part of life. We need a good, fun, campy or not campy monster movie. Every now and then you just need a monster movie to clear the palate. That's all I'm saying. So we've got that coming up. We have some special programming coming up in October. And I think I'll just leave it at that. But that will do it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976. Also, head on over to Andrew's website. And if you have any questions to ask him about night sky viewing or the book. And you can find Andrew over at thenightskyguy.com. If you want to email me a question, go ahead and send that to summer@sliceofscifi.com. Listen to the show through iTunes, through Stitcher, through TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. If you do listen on iTunes or Stitcher, leave us a review. Let other people know that you're enjoying the show, and maybe they'll think it's fun too. Check us out on Twitter @SliceOfSciFi. Check us out on Google Plus and YouTube, also Slice of Sci-Fi over there. And of course, there is the website, sliceofscifi.com. And we have a few other destinations on the intranets that might pique your interest. We have writersafterdark.com, where We review and interview authors of science fiction, fantasy, horror, nonfiction documentaries. We have interviews with filmmakers, with screenwriters. We have interviews with comics writers. Anyone who's writing the stories that we are enjoying, awesome candidate for Writers After Dark. We also have popculturegeeks.com and, of course, kickassmysticninjas.com. Keep your eye open. You never know when those ninjas will pop up. Thank you, everyone, for your donations, your pledges that keep all of this possible. Thank you so much. If you want to help support Slice of Sci-Fi and all the other shows that are being produced here, you can go to patreon.com/sliceofscifi and join the others who are helping keep this machine of science fiction geekiness afloat. Again, thank you to Sci-Fried for their theme music. I love it. I love it. And if you enjoy their music, you can also go to their website, sci-fried.com, and check out. They have some free samples, and they have some really, really good stuff on their albums. The most recent album that came out two years ago, good stuff. I really, really like Hulk Smash. I think you can preview it on their Bandcamp website. Not sure. But that'll do it for this episode. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.